extra special episode, guys, of Conspiranormal. This one we had a nice little surprise. I sent to Seraphiel the other day a post by Jay Dyer that he's going to be here in Nashville. And we've never had Jay on the show before, even though we've corresponded a couple of times.
Well, I was too much of a douchebag. I was a e-celeb douchebag, man. I don't know you guys. I'm just fucking around. Sorry. My bad.
So, yeah, it was one of those things, like I said before, where you mean to contact somebody and then you forget about
it. Forget,
and
right.
You think, oh, I can contact them later, and then you just you forget again and all this kind of stuff. So, Seraphiel is here.
Yes, sir.
He helped set this up.
Yeah, ran up on him, as they say.
Yeah, I had to go to work, and I sent to him a message that you were here. And he went over to Centennial Park where you were down there, Jay.
Yeah, I kind of just snuck in and illegally sold my books.
Yeah, I thought you'd have like a little table.
No. See, I didn't even know that was going on. I was like,
I thought you'd have a table or something. So I'm looking at all these, and then there's this dude sitting there. I recognize your shirt. I saw from a picture on Facebook. I was like, oh, that's
my
him.
Boomer shirt. Yeah.
Is that there? I thought it was tiki shirt. Yeah, shirt. Tiki shirt.
Yeah. Well, baby boomers like tiki. That's 50s tiki culture, yeah.
Yeah.
It's coming back around.
Well, thanks for inviting me out, guys. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Yeah,
absolutely, man. We showed you around a little bit around Nashville.
You did, man. You guys have been blowing my mind with this Masonic symbolism in Nashville, which I did not know about. I knew a little bit about like the Centennial Mall area, mm-hmm. all the weird stuff there, and the Parthenon, obviously, but, I mean, the degree to which you guys have been giving me this master's degree level education.
Our synchro-mystic tour is what exactly. We call it, you know, so.
Yeah, man.
Well, what really blew my mind was what you just showed me. This Presbyterian so-called church that is literally designed with Egyptian architecture. It has the sun disc, the winged sun disc right over the church.
It's modeled after a temple of the sun. That's William Strickland. It's the same architect who did the our state capitol building as well. Mm-hmm. So, and if you go inside of it, there's, like, reliefs all around of, like, palm trees and stuff. And it's basically like a sun temple to the sun god or maybe Akhenaten. I'm not exactly sure how deep he was into it, but it's pretty odd.
Well, I should have taken video imagery of it, but I guess I can clip in some of the pictures. But, it kind of blew me away. And it's on the side of the building that it literally was. You're not just conspiracy theorizing it really.
Yeah, no, it's really meant to be a replica of a sun temple.
Which has nothing to do with Christianity, really.
According to some, it does, you know, but it's very, very interesting. But this is the Athens of the South, you know, so this was there's a lot of pagan symbolism all over, because this was supposed to be this center of learning for the high society types before it then became before the hillbillies took over.
Why Athens of the South? Why Athens of the South? Like what? So basically, the idea was to create a kind of culture center, right?
Yeah. This was a center of publishing. It was a center of religious study and universities. Universities in particular, your Vanderbilt and so on.
And obviously the Freemasons would have been been that.
Oh yeah, absolutely, right? Absolutely.
You want to start on just introducing yourself, Jay, how you got into this? I guess you're most well known for your analysis of films, but what really was your path into studying all this kind of stuff?
It goes back to college to undergrad. That's the period where I really started delving into philosophy, theology, symbolism in film. I always wanted to do movies, but I realized, I don't know, about age 18, that I wasn't going to be in movies. I don't want to move to Hollywood and do that stuff. So I just took film classes, and I took history classes, and I took philosophy classes. So I was looking for a way to integrate all of them, and grad school kind of gelled that all together because I did my thesis on Bond and Ian Fleming and the symbolism in James Bond, because he actually utilized a lot of sometimes Masonic and mm-hmm. alchemical symbols in the Bond novels. The term Bond itself, bonding, right, is a chemical idea.
Never thought about that.
Yeah, it's really surprising how much of that is in the Bond novels. But that tied it into the realm of espionage. So I was studying psychological warfare and espionage as well, reading a lot of stuff on the side. And then I thought, well, why not try to integrate everything into something that in pop culture brings all these things together? So that would be film. So I just started blogging about movies. I didn't really think anything would come of it. I thought it would just be kind of a hobby.
Right.
And then it just kind of turned into a thing where somebody said, hey, do you have a book? Publisher reached out. I didn't, but I said I did. So I just took all the essays and I smashed them together in a book.
Hey.
Sent that to him, and then that led to doing one season of a TV show based on the book, roughly, with Jay Widener, of Kubrick fame. Kubrick's Odyssey.
Yeah, 237.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So then did the second book that just came out in January, and now we're shopping a new TV show to like the big network, so hopefully that'll get bought. It'll be broader than the original TV show, which was just on film symbolism. This will be all of pop culture.
Okay.
So that was the long story short, is that college plus blogging eventually just kind of snowballed into this realm.
Cool. And so you wrote your first book, Esoteric Hollywood. When did that come out?
I think it was 2016, December. And that was mainly 80 pages of Kubrick, and then it goes into H.G. Wells and Spielberg, which is crazy because you just showed me this new, in front of the Marriott here in Nashville, they have this pylon, basically, that's like binary. And it's got H.G. Wells quotes. That really blew my mind. So I'm glad we saw that. And
yeah, it's a crazy thing that people walk by here every day and don't realize.
They don't know what it is, right?
Yeah.
So that was 2016. So it goes to Kubrick, H.G. Wells, Spielberg, and then it goes to Bond and David Lynch. And then I kind of closed the book with the CIA in Hollywood. So that was book number one. And then at the same time, I was also kind of on the side just playing with doing more video stuff. So I did a lot more kind of what I call mini documentaries on YouTube, and that really grew the YouTube channel. So that's kind of where my main focus is now, although hopefully there will be a Esoteric Hollywood 3. But
yeah, I mean, one and two are great, though. And I mean, not only is it analysis of these movies, but you use these movies as a lens to explore all the topics that are in it, too, and give a bunch of information about that. So
yeah, because it brings in all these different realms. So it's like geopolitics and espionage and secret societies and, you know, masonry and alchemy, plus actual history versus Hollywood.
Yeah.
So it's a weird mix. And I didn't really know if it would work, but
like, it works.
People, the analyses resonate with people, and you mentioned, like, Hoffman and people like that, and there was a... He kind of inspired me a long time ago because he did analysis of Conspiracy Theory, the Mel Gibson movie, in the style of the way I do it.
Okay.
So I kind of got it from that.
Cool.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we can segue into that as far as films come from this tradition you talk about of theater, and theater has all these roots in ritual and ceremony. And film can be seen as ritual, as almost a kind of spell casting, towards the viewer, towards the masses, and this relates to Hoffman and Downard's ideas about revelation of the method, which is that society and individuals are alchemically transformed by these mass rituals, but one element of that is that symbolism allows that consent is a big part of it, even if it's only subconscious. And symbolism is seen to be able to do that in the esoteric realm, but in the film realm, I guess these movies can almost be seen as the population giving consent to things that are actually taking place in the world.
You're absolutely right. Yeah. So my first analysis is Eyes Wide Shut. That was kind of the more popular one that I did, and I took that very thesis to it. I took the thesis that Kubrick is kind of taking the individual on a ritual journey, and I wouldn't have even known about that idea had I not been aware of the idea of revelation of the method. So I think that Kubrick was attempting to initiate the viewer, whether they knew it or not. They don't have to give a consent, but they're going along the journey with Bill Harford. So I think you're spot on. And really, the idea of revelation of the method pretty much permeates both volumes.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why I didn't realize how much of an influence those ideas were on you. And, you know, of course, I'm a total Downard freak, so that immediately, you know, sparked my interest. I was like, yeah, this is...
Yeah, I mean, it's not revelation of method is definitely a big part of it, because that plays into gaslighting, psychological warfare, yeah. that stuff. There's a little bit of synchromysticism in the Close Encounters chapter, because I noticed some really weird stuff. Like, if you remember the section in the movie where the printout shows coordinates, and those coordinates happen to be the Denver airport, pretty much.
Really?
In the vicinity of the Denver airport, which
that's interesting.
Is very bizarre, because we all know about the Denver, but But it was also, I think there's an article in the 2000s in the Washington Post, early 2000s, that talked about Denver as a very important relocation spot for the CIA. Okay. It's actually a lot of CIA operations. I mean, they're in Langley, obviously, but there's also a lot going on in Denver. So that has a lot to do probably with the underground base lore and all that kind of stuff.
I think there's a little bit of that kind of like continuity of government stuff from the 80s.
Oh, totally, dude.
Oh, yeah.
All that.
In the mountains.
Yeah, all the kind of FEMA-based conspiracies. Yeah.
So Rex 84.
Jade Helms.
Yeah.
One thing I really appreciate about the elaboration, too, is, you know, people explore these ideas before, and it seems abstract. Okay, these films or mass media or these ritualized events are geared towards changing the population or alchemically transforming the population, but what does that really mean? And you elaborate more on it, that the goal is what you call fragmentation, both on the individual level and, I guess, on a societal level. Can you kind of elaborate on that?
Yeah, so basically what I meant by that was, if you're familiar with the CIA's MKUltra program, one of the things that they really focused and honed in on that Huxley talks about initially was that they realized the ability of the hallucinogens in a negative way would affect people in terms of dissociation. And so I kind of really looked for the possibility that films, and not just films, but pop music, pop art, could it have the potential to cause dissociation, or to try to induce it, or to try to fragment people's perception. And then what I realized was that if you study the black arts, in the sense of like the connection between voodoo or black magic, and how even the military, in terms of psychological warfare, has actually studied those things.
Yeah.
Because if you think about it, I mean, not necessarily, although there could be casting a spell, but let's say drug use, right? I mean, the shaman could use a drug, and, you know, on his enemies or whatever. So the same idea of biological warfare is essentially just using drugs on the target enemy. So in the same way, if drugs can have those effects, the question becomes, could films have those effects? Could music have that, right? Now think about Abu Ghraib, where we all heard stories of Britney Spears or Metallica or whatever it was, and Barney, I Love You, being blasted supposedly to torture
like
people.
Manuel Noriega playing Van Halen out of right. that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And then when I noticed when I watched Apocalypse Now, there's that scene where they're coming over the hill with the Blackhawks or whatever it is, and they're blasting
Flight of the Valkyries.
Yes, and if you're like a Viet Cong country dude, you've never heard this, it would freak you out.
Yeah, oh yeah.
They actually did that. That was a real thing they did. So
That goes into the Phoenix program.
Exactly.
The Wandering Soul.
Doug Valentine.
Stuff. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So I started noticing it, you know, those patterns coming up, and that there was such a close connection between psychological warfare and movies, Pentagon and Hollywood. And then you come across things like, and I put it in the first book, this crazy stuff like Sir Alexander Korda, who was the first British filmmaker who was knighted by the Queen. He and his circles were involved in basically being in the groups called they're called the Irregulars, and this is people like Ian Fleming and Noel Coward, who came over to the U.S. to help set up the OSS. So British intelligence came over here. They helped set that up. And some of these people were, like, heavily in the British film industry. So I'm starting to notice these parallels. Obviously, everybody knows about Ian Fleming. But not everybody knows he was, like, a high-level naval psyops dude. Long story short, I realized that they were studying film on a psychological warfare level to see all of its different potentialities, including dissociation and fragmentation. And I think that the whole project, I would say, of ruling society from the time of the Enlightenment down to now, and even perhaps into the ancient world, involves the idea of fragmenting people into not being able to make large-scale connections. So if you can't make bigger scale connections, if your perspective is fragmented, then you won't see patterns and you won't figure things out.
How does that play into what we experience now with our cell phones and even that's taking the whole film idea to like the nth degree, to like a whole other level? I mean, we were talking about this earlier and joking that like your cell phone basically is an extension of you now.
Yeah, it's a body mod extension. It's a little magic mirror. I mean, I've been saying it's like a magic mirror. And in fact, what I talked about in the Kubrick Arthur C. Clarke section was that Clark originally wanted it to be a screen, and it was going to be images projected to the monkeys that the monkeys would have been like, whoa, it's a TV.
We were discussing American Cosmic before, and that's in Diana Pasuka's book. That's a concept that she lays out. It's not original to her. I forget the author that she was borrowing, kicking that from. But essentially, your cell phone is the monolith.
Yeah. Yeah, we talked about that in the TV show. I think Wiener brought it up that it bears such a strange parallel to the iPhone that it has to be worth mentioning. I don't know if they intentionally thought that was right. The iPhone, but yeah, it was supposed to be a TV and it would transfix the monkeys, and then the idea being the screen would either lead to man's enslavement or that the elite would use this to propel themselves into the next stage of evolution. I mean, that's the whole point of 2001 is transhumanism. But anyway, so yes, I think that the devices are just little magic mirrors that that put us into a little autistic loop of a niche where we don't even recognize what's out. And I mean, it's even worse than before the iPhone. Like, even before, people didn't know about Masonic symbolism in the city and how the cities are structured.
Yeah, but now no one even looks up.
Now they don't even look up because yeah, exactly right.
So back to the film ideas. That's a good segue when you touched on the Flight of the Valkyries, because isn't that something that Wagner really talked about? Is that at the time opera was the ultimate art form because it was audio and visual and literary all combined. So that's really what film inherited, it seems like.
It did, yeah, and that's what made it so much more powerful for propaganda. And in fact, even the Vatican in the 40s or 50s had to do a whole encyclical on the power of film, because they were worried that this could out-propagandize the Vatican. And in fact, the word propaganda itself actually comes from the Holy Office of the Inquisition. They are the ones who began propaganda. So I think that they saw the potential for Hollywood to have a degrading effect on society.
Yes.
I'm not saying that makes the Vatican perfect or good, but one thing that's correct in that encyclical or that apostolic address or whatever is that it does see the potential for film to completely transform people's perspectives and worldviews. That's why it's so useful to psychological warfare and propaganda, and that's why the military was studying it from the very get-go. So there's several chapters in both books where I go deep into that, trying to explain how that's why you saw so many war movies.
Yeah.
All those war movies were churned out for propaganda.
Can you kind of give some background to people who may not understand that history? Just kind of a primer on it for people on the role of both military and intelligence in the film industry?
It goes back to the very beginning, and so I think so when they first saw that early images on the camera scared people. Like, if you've ever seen that old picture of the train coming, the people that were watching that for the first time, they thought they were going to get
the train. The great train robbery the guy shooting the gun at the end. People actually ducked in the theater.
That would obviously catch the eyes of the elite. You know, they would notice this. They would be like, okay, how can we use this? Because that's usually how the mindset of the elite is how can I use this to structure and control society? So they saw the potential for this, and pretty early on, even into the 20s, I would say, the first blockbusters of the 20s, which I have a chapter on Howard Hughes. That's why Howard Hughes is so important, is that he was making movies like Hell's Angels that were the, you know, the big blockbusters of their day, putting all his own money into it. Plus, he was tied to the deep state of his day, which is pretty obvious. Even if you watch the Martin Scorsese movie, it's pretty obvious that's what's going on. And then, so he was churning out propaganda films at that time. Even the Soviets did the same thing. Eisenstein, Battle for Potemkin. What's the one about the Alexander Nevsky?
October, which was another one of his.
Yeah. So the Soviets were doing it too. They realized they could do it. And then, of course, the Nazis had a huge role in using the camera and actually advancing camera technology for the purpose of psychological warfare. So it's always been there. It's always been present. And then it just gets even crazier when you look into the fact that the heads of the major networks, when they first came to be, they were all out of the OSS. Mm-hmm. People like Sarnoff, Paley, all these former OSS guys, they just magically pop up in running the big networks. I mean, no. What they did was they took all of their psychological warfare knowledge and people from the advertising world, Walter Lippmann, places like that, the research that Bernays was doing, he was working for the government, and they just applied all that to these, quote, private companies, which aren't really private companies. They've always been in this public-private partnership, you could say.
I think people get the idea that after the movie Argo came out, that this was that was like the beginning of the CIA and Hollywood. Like, no, it was going on way before then.
Even to the point of like big name actors and actresses having been spies, and the Soviets did the same thing too. There was a woman, I always forget her name, but one of the top actresses of the Soviet Union was Stalin's right hand spy, Marlene Dietrich. She was a spy for the Nazis. Coco Chanel was a spy for the Nazis. Errol Flynn was a spy. Don't forget, one of the best is, pretty sure Cary Grant did something, although I haven't confirmed that, but Jimmy Stewart was an informer for the FBI. He actually was. Well, I mean,
He was in the Army. He was in the Army Air Corps. You know, before.
Right.
You know.
So if you watch, you can find archive footage on YouTube from Laurel Canyon. Some of the movies people have found and put up. So there's all these clips of Jimmy Stewart doing Laurel Canyon propaganda. It's pretty crazy.
That's, man. I guess the other side of this would be the influence of the occult on Hollywood, the influence of certain figures and a lot of directors and actors and people being influenced by the occult as well.
Right.
So where does that kind of start?
Well, in my book, I went back to, if you look at the last chapter of the second book, I go to German Expressionism and
Metropolis,
yeah, from Fritz Lang, because pretty much all the scholarship that I found on that, mainline scholarship, all said that it was the first conscious satanic usage in film, was German Expressionism. Which is weird, because Metropolis isn't really a satanic film. It kind of has a positive message in a way, because
it's more of a socialist kind of message.
And the message seems to be that, like, the heart of society, if you look at society like a big man, the way Plato does, like it's a macrocosm or a microcosm. If you have the elite or the brains working against the workers, the body or the heart, then the society won't work right. So there has to be harmony, which, yeah, that's from the Hermetic realm, but, I mean, it's kind of true. It seems like, you know, you can't have the elite trampling on the workers. It doesn't work. And then the idea is that, well, what happens when this AI gets built? And I think that's the most fascinating aspect. It's not just the Moloch and all the esoteric stuff, but that they foresaw AI.
That really
kind of blows my mind. And, I mean, as you can see, it's like, you know,
big pentagram.
At the base of the pentagram is the AI, which it has kind of an anti, you know, she becomes basically the whore of Babylon. Basically.
Something I never noticed before. And she's depicted in that way, right?
Right.
The whore of Babylon.
She is. That's what she's called. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. That's in a dream sequence, I believe, that the main character is having.
Correct.
Yeah.
Right. And then I also found some old, like, B movies like Cherry 2000 and other themes like that were similar to this. So basically there's like an android sex bot section of the book. But so I would say you could go back to that, the German Expressionists, for the beginning of the occult in film. But even into the 40s and 50s in noir films, I've even found weird symbolism and occult references in a lot of original noir films. Like Glass Key, I think. There's a section where I discuss some of the Bogart films with Now, what's her name?
Lauren Bacall.
Lauren Bacall, exactly. Yeah. So there's, and then you start to notice that they're actually referencing. I think it's Glass Key, but I never noticed they were filming porn.
Yeah.
But they couldn't say that in the movie, so if you have to pay attention. Looking back, you can figure it out. But.
And I guess this is when, and a little bit before that is when the occultist Kenneth Anger, and filmmaker, and he I guess he really, you know, like he was in celebration of that.
He was, yeah. My book, I would say, is kind of like springboarded off of Hollywood Babylon, but the difference being that he talks about a lot of like 20s, 30s W.C. Fields people that most people nowadays don't really know about or care about. Whereas what I do is go directly into the symbolism of the film itself. So I would be more interested in like Lucifer Rising and the stuff that he was doing than his book. Although it does, like I actually began the book, I think, with a quote from Hollywood Babylon. Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, because he calls it the Gates of the Gods, basically.
Is there any influence on from Manly P. Hall being there and the whole Los Angeles milieu of the time?
There would be. I mean, you've got a lot of actors and actresses who were involved in different secret societies. I touch on that quite a bit. And certainly many of the men would have been Freemasons, there's no doubt. A lot of the studio heads were Freemasons, like MGM heads, people like that, no doubt.
But Disney, of course.
Yeah, exactly. But...
Which I think they're kind of opening up about Club 33 right. now.
Yeah.
I've seen that they've done some events that are, I think, semi-public even now.
Did you know that it was the CIA that helped Walt get the land to set that up?
No, I didn't.
Yeah. It's crazy.
Which, I mean, you know Bosley, too, so he's got his theories on Disneyland itself being some kind of device,
Energy generator?
Essentially. Do you know it has its own bylaws and constitution?
Yeah.
Isn't that weird?
Well, I know that in Disney World, for Epcot Center, their original idea was almost to have like this kind of a utopian.
It is. It's a smart city.
Yeah.
It was called the City of the Future. I did a video on that where it was preparing people for creating the AI smart city.
Yeah, I still have a childhood memory of whatever the robot world was. I just remember going up a giant escalator and all these robots and shit. It's like ingrained in there. I don't know, man. But yeah, there's definitely something to it. There's some of the biggest, I guess, examples. Maybe we could give some general descriptions of some of the symbolism. Like, let's say just 2001, one that everybody knows. I mean, what's your kind of take on that? I know, it has a lot of obvious connotations, maybe some stuff that other people don't see as much in it, or kind of your take on, say, something like 2001 or Kubrick in general. I guess that's like a whole, he has so many of his movies relate to all this stuff.
It's like a five-hour...
Yeah.
It is, yeah. In fact, that's why in the TV show, that's why we did multiple episodes on Kubrick. So we have an episode on 2001, we have an Eyes Wide Shut episode, we have a Shining episode, and I think, that's all the chapters in my book, the first 80, are those Kubrick films. I think 2001, and this is the one film where Jay Widener and I had kind of a disagreement and debate. He sees it as a positive appraisal of man's movement. I take more of a critical approach where I see it as the promulgation of transhumanism. I mean, Star Child is supposed to be actually the result of... it's almost like Hal is leading, my view is Hal is almost leading Bowman to do what he does. So even though we think, when we watch that movie, we think, oh, it's man versus machine, who's going to triumph? It actually, if you look at the series where it goes, by 3001, Arthur C. Clarke's very clear that Hal and Bowman become one entity called Halman. It's transhumanism. So Star Child is, I think, it's a Luciferian apotheosis. That's what I see it as. That's the monolith represents the beyond. It represents achieving apotheosis by mastering the technology, whatever this unknown, mysterious technology is that the monkeys are xenophobic about. It's about mastering that. It seems to perhaps be some kind of AI. I almost think Kubrick is telling us that we're in this matrix, because if you think about it, when Bowman leaves, when he goes to the Stargate, he sees like colors and the fabric of reality kind of breaks down into these geometric patterns. Then he steps outside of reality, Plato's cave. That's how I read it. Almost like getting out of the matrix. I mean, I literally see 2001 as I read it like the Matrix. So when he gets out of it, then he can be reborn as Star Child, and then he can create his own worlds.
So
but
it's almost a Gnostic element.
It is totally Gnostic. So that's totally what I see it as.
In 2010, at the end, and I've only seen the movie, I haven't read the book, but in 2010, at the end, you know, Hal asks Dave, you know, where am I going?
Yeah.
And he says, oh, where I am now. So this idea that, you know, Hal, he's not a biological entity, but he's an artificial intelligence. So
exactly.
Therefore, the two intelligences are going to be
merged. You know, they become Halman.
As if Hal has a spirit of his own.
Right. Yeah. So it's almost like a god entity. The AI is viewed like a god entity. It's the emergent deity, the Deus Ex Machina. And then when Bowman unites with it, it's spoken of in 3001. It's almost like a chariot. Like he rides around in this chariot, the way the Bible describes Ezekiel's chariot. Like it's this.
I guess this goes back to Arthur C. Clarke's, the whole, you know, technology.
It is, exactly.
Looking like magic.
And they have Arthur C. Clarke quotes at the Marriott on the ground. That blew me away. Down there by the H.G. Wells, they've got Arthur C. Clarke quotes down there.
So we can go to, like, transhumanism. Is there anywhere you'd like to go in that? Or it seems like there's a real technological determinism and transhumanism that's being pushed from Hollywood. What movies in particular do you see, and what kind of what's really the goal of pushing these narratives of this being a unavoidable technological?
Well, I started with an area that you might not expect in the book, where I talk about NGOs, non-government organizations, how they're really the soft power in the world today.
Yeah,
they function in the way that covert operations used to function. But they do it in a more open way behind the cloak of, we're going to spread democracy and freedom. But they're actually just tools for bigger interests, bigger power blocks. So the reason that relates to transhumanism is because what NGOs, what propaganda, what movies, what all this stuff does, this cultural sludge, you could say, is intended to change perceptions. Not just change perceptions about the world or other nations, but as that one Stanford research document says, changing images of man.
Oh yeah, that's a
man's
good one.
Changing images of himself. So, a big part of that is Darwin. A big part of that is evolution. A big part of that is the so-called rights movements. So NGOs are big about promoting so-called rights, and this is ultimately just a Masonic philosophy: natural rights, Declaration of the Rights of Man out of the French Revolution. These rights, although I'm not opposed to rights, they're weaponized rights. They're not about what they claim to be about. They're just about changing the local cultures under those glowing terms to make them more amenable to the overall plan of globalism.
Kind of more the fragmentation stuff.
It is. Well, like, we're going to go into some third world country and we're going to educate the women for women's issues, when ultimately this is just about spreading abortion and depopulation. Women's education and women's rights in third world countries is not really about aiding women. It's about promoting that stuff. So that the way it relates to transhumanism is that these are kind of stepping stones on the long-term goal of engineering people to accept, like we were talking about earlier about the phone being the extension of you. So eventually
future.
You become cyborgs. Yeah, so that's, and there's just so many films that have that theme, even in a critical way, like a, you know, dystopian critique way. You could look at Tron. I covered The Matrix, the obvious ones, but I think that it was important to have those in the book. Running Man, Terminator, Her, Ex Machina, Westworld, Cherry 2000, because I like to throw in B-movies every now and then to just make it fun, and then Metropolis, which is the oldest transhumanist movie I could think of.
I really liked your analysis of the Alien series, too.
Thank you.
Because those were, that's something
you got like terraforming and all kinds of weird, like, and then the whole world is an abortion, like,
and the demonic aspects
Eager,
of it, also,
exactly.
Absolutely fascinating stuff, man. Adam, you want to add anything?
I guess, the main thing I was gonna go back to the Downard stuff a little bit and some of those connections.
Well, I drove past the pyramid in Memphis, and it's got a crystal skull at the top, which I first heard about from James Shelby Downard, so that's pretty crazy.
Oh, yeah.
And, well, I mean, he... I think his writings really introduced a lot of people to just thinking about symbolism. I mean, it seems like he's really the genesis of all this kind of stuff, this like synchro mysticism,
exactly.
It's gone through so many permutations of culture now that a lot of people don't really understand how much of the genesis, I think, was with James Shelby Downer. But, I mean, that's where it really all started for me in looking at the world in this way and recognizing symbolism and this whole idea of the powers that be using events, using media to transform
the
population
the mind,
and the mind on the micro and macro level.
Exactly.
So I think that's really what all
it
this is,
and that's why it relates
is.
Directly to propaganda. Because if you're looking at it from a military or control perspective, you could see the obvious usage of that.
Is there a connection also? Because we started talking about Ian Fleming, and of course, you know, he did know Crowley. What kind of is there a lot of
well, he was in
the
circles.
And from,
yeah,
from
he was
in a lot of this.
Yeah, you'll find in the first book there's a dissected analysis of The Devil Rides Out, which is a Dennis Wheatley film, and Wheatley was in the circles. He hung out with Crowley. Fleming himself didn't actually ever meet him, but they were in the same circles. But Wheatley actually designed a lot of the characters in the stories around Crowley. The Mokata character in Devil Rides Out.
Yes.
It's totally Crowley.
Yep.
So you'll like that essay there, and I go deep into like the British intelligence connections to the occult in that section, that chapter. But no, there's definitely a Crowley connection. In fact, even though Fleming didn't know Crowley, Blofeld and Le Chiffre, the two Bond villains, are partly based on Crowley.
That's interesting. I never
why Blofeld's bald.
Yeah. I've wondered about it because, you know, I watched some of the earlier James Bond films, and to me it almost seems like Spectre is kind of like that underground Nazi international.
It's the elite, yeah. In Fleming's personal library, he had a bunch of books on eugenics and depopulation, so he was aware of this, and that's why he's putting people, especially the Drax character in Moonraker. Hugo Drax is part of the Nazi elite that wanted to mass depopulate. Now the movie is goofy, but the Hugo Drax character in the movie still has that idea. So when you read part one, you'll see in the Moonraker chapter where I touch on that.
Yeah. That's fascinating.
Yeah, man.
Fascinating stuff. Is there anything that you wanted to add real quick?
No, I mean, we're gonna wrap it up here because we're kind of out of time. But we've had a great time today. Nice to meet you, man, and show you a little synchro mystical tour of the city.
Yeah, that was awesome. Yeah.
And look forward to getting another interview in the future, maybe,
you're
keeping up with whatever you're working on.
We'll go into more detail in a more kind of full scale interview. We'll put this out as like a little bonus episode for
Conspiranormal.
That's right.
Excellent. Cool.
All right, guys. Thank you so much, Jay, for doing this, man.
Thank you, man.
Meeting up with us. And,
it's a pleasure.
Guys, thank you for listening, and we'll be back on the regular show. It's Paranormal.
Conspiranormal, or leave a one-time donation at conspiranormal.com. And please check out our YouTube channel, Conspiranormal Podcast.